From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dennis Potter wrote two of the most interesting PBS imports from the BBC, Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective. The Singing Detective was about a detective writer with a hideous and crippling combination of psoriasis and arthritis, a condition that the writer Dennis Potter has. Potter is in New York for a retrospective of his work. We'll talk with him on today's Fresh Air. Naked Lunch is a hallucinatory film based on the 1959 hallucinatory novel by William Burroughs. Coming up, we talk about Burroughs' life and work with Anne Charters, who has written about and anthologized the work of the Beat writers. And rock historian Ed Ward travels back 30 years to 1962. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and Jordan began their first ever formal peace talks today, and Jordan said Israeli withdrawal from the occupied West Bank would not be a precondition to peace. At the same time, Israel began face-to-face negotiations with members of the stateless Palestinians who live on land controlled by Israel and are seeking self-government. Separate talks between Israel and Syria produce no movement. Meanwhile, seven Jewish settlers were injured when their bus was ambushed in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The bus was traveling from Jerusalem to the West Bank settlement of Shiloh. Near the Arab town of Ramallah, it was fired on. Seven settlers, including two children, were injured. One of the children is in serious condition. The other child had been injured in a similar bus attack 2 months ago and was returning from a routine checkup in the hospital. Angry Jewish settlers called on Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Arens to resign. The settlers say the army is not doing enough to protect them. Military sources said they are doing their best to stop the violence, but they also said that as the Arab-Israeli peace talks progress, Palestinians opposed to these peace talks will try to increase the level of violence. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The ruling military council in Algeria may soon take steps to ban the Islamic Salvation Front, despite its overwhelming victory in national elections. Matt Fry filed this report for the BBC from Algiers.
The Algerian authorities and the Islamic Salvation Front are playing a cat-and-mouse game in which the fundamentalists have been cast as the mouse. Having seen their electoral victory annulled, they now face the prospect of being outlawed. Western diplomatic and Algerian government sources say they expect this to happen. The question is when. The Islamic Salvation Front is also preparing itself for such an eventuality. The party's leadership seems, however, to be split, whether to confront the situation head-on by calling on its supporters to go out into the streets, or whether to keep a low profile and go underground. The fundamentalists have good reasons to fear military intervention. Their two leaders are already in military jails, facing charges of plotting against the state. The government's strategy has amounted to a gradual clampdown, avoiding gestures that are too dramatic.
Matt Fry reporting. British Prime Minister John Major says a special summit of the 15-member United Nations Security Council will be held January 31st. Great Britain had proposed the summit, which is expected to focus on issues like the expanding role of UN peacekeeping forces and efforts to control the spread of nuclear technology and other weapons. The five countries with permanent seats on the council will attend, along with Russian President Boris Yeltsin. The other 10 countries who hold rotating seats also plan to attend. Stocks closed with another record high on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials advanced nearly 61 points to end the day at 3246.20. Advances led declines in very heavy trading. This is NPR. The American Academy of Pediatrics today called for a ban on handguns and assault weapons to help stop fatal shootings that kill more than 4,000 young people a year. That figure is up by a third from only 3 years before. The 42,000-member Academy is the first public health organization to call for banning such arms. Its policy also mandates cutting the romanticization of guns on television and in the movies. The association urges that parents be educated about the dangers of handguns in the home. A superior court in Massachusetts will decide who rightfully owns thousands of documents that once belonged to civil rights leader Martin Luther King. Lisa Mullins of member station WBUR reports.
There are 83,000 documents at issue. That's about one-third of King's manuscripts and correspondence. They primarily include sermons King wrote on yellow legal pads, some that are considered foreshadowings of his I Have a Dream speech. Also, letters, including hate mail, and a strict diet prescribed by an Alabama doctor. In 1964, 4 years before he died, King wrote to Boston University saying the school would be the repository for the papers after his death. King earned his doctorate in theology at BU. In 1987, Coretta Scott King sued the university, saying her husband's letter to the school is not binding and that the papers belong with the bulk of Dr. King's archives at the King Center in Atlanta. A judge in Boston yesterday said the case is too complicated to settle out of court. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston.
The nation's retail sales dropped over the Christmas shopping season for a disappointing third year in a row. The Commerce Department says Christmas sales were the lowest in nearly 30 years. Analysts see little chance for improvement before summer because of consumer worries about jobs and income. Others say that the report, which was worse than predicted, could mean that the economy may have slipped back into recession. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Museum of Television and Radio in Manhattan is showing a retrospective of the work of one of the most innovative writers in television, Dennis Potter. Most of his work has been done for the BBC. In America, he's best known for the series Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective, which were both shown on public TV. He also wrote the screenplay for the American film adaptation of Pennies from Heaven, which starred Steve Martin and Bernadette Peters. Now Potter is directing as well. His new theatrical release is Secret Friends. What I respond to most in Potter's work is the way he uses pop music from the 30s and 40s in both The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven. When characters want to express their deepest feelings, they hear in their minds pop songs that express those thoughts. The characters, as if possessed by the songs, lip-sync along and are transformed by the music. The Singing Detective is about a middle-aged detective writer hospitalized with a horrible, disfiguring condition, a combination of extreme psoriasis and arthritis. Dennis Potter himself is often stricken with this disease. In this scene, a female nurse is applying an ointment to the writer's raw thighs, and he is gravely embarrassed to find he's getting aroused, so he tries to think boring, distracting thoughts.
We can start now.
Oh, cock, do not crow. Poor cock, do not stir.
I'll be as gentle as I can.
Oh, think of something boring, for Christ's sake. Think of something very, very, very boring. A speech. A speech by Ted Heath. A sentence, a long sentence from Bernard Levin. A quiz by Christopher Booker. Oh. No. Think. Really boring. A Welsh male voice choir. Everything in punch. Oh.
Oh, poor thing.
Oh, wage rates in Peru. James Burke. Finnegan's Wake. All the bloody Irish. The dog in Blue Peter. Brian Clough. And especially James. Henry Ann Clive. Australian barman. Ecologist. Semiologist. Thing. Guardian Woman's Page. Oh, dear Christ. Yes. The Bible. Oh, God, Reader's Digest, special draw prize. No. Think Bible. Bible Psalms. Song of Solomon. Thy breasts are like... No. Oh.
Sorry. Is that too hard?
Too hard, yes. It's like iodine in a cut.
I'm sorry, but it's worst of all just here inside your thighs. I'm being as gentle as I can.
Oh, it's not your fault. No.
I'm sorry, but I shall have to lift your penis now to grease round it.
My mama done told me when I was in pigtails.
I have to talk to you about songs.
Songs.
Because I think it's so powerful, the way you express people's inner life and inner dreams and desires through the popular songs of the 30s and 40s. Did you want to live in the world of those songs?
No, many of those songs I actually hate, to be quite honest. It's like what Noah Coward said about the potency of cheap music. Some of those banal and silly, syncopated, syrupy lyrics and tunes, like much popular art, they make you do all the work. I mean, in themselves, intrinsically, they may not have that much value. But even the most drivelly, syrupy, syncopated piece of mush is in direct line of descent from the Psalms, in my opinion, in that they say, or they're seeking to say, that the dead, suffocating materiality of the real world and the way we're locked into it, that there is something else shimmering, something that may be very cheap and may be very banal, but it says, you know, that love is there and is forever, or the sun is shining, or it infiltrates into that because it's so easy and because it's so undemanding. It makes you do the work. It's a great art, of course, great music, demands that you genuflect before, that you bend the knee to it, you give it, it demands your attention. Popular art in general makes you do the work because you put yourself into it, which is why in drama, using those songs and making the actors lip sync to them so that they're genuine artifacts from the past, like a costume would be or a piece of furniture might be, it enables me to feel as though I'm getting inside the head. And, you know, we all have this little theater on top of our shoulders, bobbing along on top of our shoulders.
Did anyone in your family sing?
My mother played the piano in the working men's club in the Forest of Dean, in the sort of coal mining village where I grew up. She sang. And she was popular as a result.
Was she transformed when she sang in any way?
Well, she was, and we were. In a sort of miners' club, for example, there's hardworking people drinking, yes. And as the evening wears on, some of the old songs would start coming out. And it was an odd place, the Forest of Dean, anyway. It's like it's between the two rivers, the Wye and the Severn, on the borders of England and Wales, and was, when I was a child in the war, quite isolated and ugly villages because they were coal mining villages, but a genuine forest creeping right up to the back garden, as it were, a forest real enough to get lost in, and a landscape that was stony and green and grey and grubby all at the same time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Potter, and he's probably best known in America for writing The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven. He wrote and directed the new movie Secret Friends. There's a retrospective of his work about to begin in New York. Your new movie, Secret Friends, is in part about the danger of fantasies and the danger of living out those fantasies. And that's really a recurrent theme in a lot of your work. And I was wondering if you lived in the fantasy world, if that was your place, coming of age in a coal mining town.
To a degree, I think everyone does to some degree. But there are fantasies and fantasies. I mean, fantasy can be one of those registrable sexual diseases, I think, for example. I mean, it can. You know that when people don't see each other true, when they don't deal with reality and allow fantasy to displace reality, you know that that is actually a form of illness. Yeah, but without some fantasy of some order or some... It's a kissing cousin to imagination, isn't it? And without that imagination to leaven and in a sense, order our experience, then we're less than human.
Another related theme that recurs in a lot of your work is growing up in a very repressive atmosphere, repressive parents, repressive teachers. Was that true for you? Did you grow up in a repressive atmosphere?
Well, I wouldn't say it was repressive. I mean, it had standards and had that right-wing part of myself will come out in a minute, because I do believe that those kinds of respect for order and decency and the working class culture that I grew up in coincided also with the fact that the world was mad. I mean, there were German planes overhead, making that peculiar broken noise, so you knew they were the German planes. They go, rather than one continuous note, and each horizon lit by searchlights, the assumption. The first long word I ever learned, I used to love words as a child. I still do, actually, but where the teacher's leaning over the railings and opposite, there's just a little village school and the oak trees opposite where we played, and I heard that France had capitulated. I loved the word capitulated. I didn't know what it meant. Ran all the way home. But capitulated in my mouth like a pebble, you know, like it was a jewel. I got a word, lovely new long word. I was five. but that was the word. So of course all those things were affecting the way one grew up. That the normal condition was there were Germans trying to kill you. And the assumption of England at that time, I mean, I think even little children were politicized. Everybody knew. And nobody thought we were going to lose. That was so amazing.
Getting back to the repressive atmosphere that is
you're really hung up on repression, aren't you?
Well, no, it's that it's in so much of your work. I figure it must be something that you've experienced and thought about a lot. I was wondering what kinds of things you were punished for when you were young.
Being naughty. I don't know, the ordinary things. There would be a smack or being uppity. Just objectively speaking, no immodesty or any of that. Just as a measurement, I do have a sort of off-the-scale IQ. And I was obviously very, very bright as a child as a result in a way that, you know, probably wasn't understood time. And it is a curse, actually, in a small, tight, suffocatingly interned, simple-ish working-class village to be, quote, clever, unquote, and to seek education in that way. And that...
Why is it a curse?
Well, because you will get bullied, won't you? If the teacher, leaving the room, says, come out to the front, Dennis, and tell us a story... that sounds like an honor. It's actually a punishment because you're going to be resented by the others. And I assumed that I was going to grow up and be a coal miner. They did and did. I didn't. I went through that treacherous minefield called the English class system, which involves betrayal. You don't know it at the time. You're too young to know it. I came from a culture that... with a very strong dialect where people do and still do say thee and thou, you know, where bist thou going, O butty, or Surrey, they say, which is Sirrah. And it's only, 40 miles or so from Shakespeare's birthplace. And the accents of the people, which is also naturally in tune with the accents of the King James Bible, that wonderful, simple English, which is resonant, aching with beauty and tenderness. But to go in that from there all the way by accident and examination to Oxford involves you making judgments about your own without knowing you're making, because you are seduced into making those judgments by what you think is of just learning and education. It does mean that you are trapped into making value judgments about your own home.
Is success interpreted as turning your back against your own class?
Well, it can be, and it is when you're very young. And if you start making judgments, because if you start thinking that an ability to speak Latin somehow, for example, makes you better than someone who doesn't and can't, or if you know more, or if you read more, or if you seek those things, you can, by the very arrogance of youth, you can be trapped into making those false judgments. And it's only later that you receive the pain of knowing that you have, although you've gained so much, you've also lost something. When I was used to, my dad is dead now. Died in 1975, and he didn't read and things, but he was an incredibly gentle and sensitive man whose life was spent in the pits. But when he'd talked about something in the past, he would somehow describe the color of the sky, or sometimes he'd draw an apple on the white margins of a newspaper. And when I would be writing, after I'd started writing television plays and so on, sometimes I would be trying to finish something, and he'd come out and he would lean on the door jamb looking into the room where I was working, and I maybe was sort of slightly irritated, thinking, I don't actually want a conversation at this moment. I want to finish this scene, say. And he would say, "Is thou all right? Oh, but, Dan, you all right?" And I'd say, "Yes, thank you, Dad." "You sure you're all right now?" Within that accent. And, of course, now, if I could only say, "Oh, please, Dad, come on in."
Yeah.
But you can't, can you? But you can have a continuing relationship with the dead. Any parish includes the dead as well as the living.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Potter, and he's best known in America for writing The Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven, which were both produced for the BBC and shown in America on public television. He also wrote the screenplay for the film version of Pennies from Heaven, and he's written and directed a new movie called Secret Friends. We're going to take a short break. We'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Potter is my guest. The main character in your screenplay, The Singing Detective, has a condition that combines psoriasis and arthritis, which is the condition that you have. When did you first get that?
30 years ago. It's like a plague, you know. People say, "Oh, I've got psoriasis," people say, and they mean they've got a few rings or scales on their skin, whereas this kind is... the killer kind, 100%. You cannot find a gap in your when it attacks first. It started actually with the arthritis in every single joint, went just like that. I was actually on this newspaper, the Daily Herald, which I'd left the BBC because I wanted politics, and obviously you cannot express political opinions as a staff member of the BBC. And I was covering a political conference at the press table. I was feeling a bit low anyway. I was sort of wallowing towards what I knew was a kind of desperate disappointment with things in general, without being able to say what specifically it was. But when I went to get up from the press table, I suddenly couldn't. I looked down thinking, what the hell is wrong? And my left knee, which is where it was like a football. You know, it was literally 4 or 5 times its proper size within half an hour or so. And I didn't know what it was. And it, in fact, took some time to diagnose properly what it was. And during that time, bang, I just went. Then my hands collapsed in, and it's still active, so I can't have those little rubber joints put in. So I can just move the forefinger and thumb. The other fingers are permanently down on the palm. But then, you know, with the steroid, you know, that long regime of treatment over... I'm talking now, this is the winter of 61, 62, and it began. I had 2 small children, and I had lost my job. In a way, I was lucky in that at the same time, I knew that I had to... In a way, it sounds crude, but I'm using it as a metaphor... I had to reinvent myself. I had to find in myself what it was, what it was that I was so wretchedly disappointed about without knowing what it was, if you follow me. But also, I'd always had this sense of... It's such an old-fashioned word, it makes people snigger, but of vocation, that there was some significance. And now that's perilously close to mental illness when you too readily admit to that condition. You're saying when you know that there is some significance to your life and that there is a vocation to which you should submit, the sheer desperation of that kind of opened up the entry to a path that began to stretch ahead of me instead of behind me. So far from things seeming to be over, you know, and that one would be in a permanently medical nightmare, there actually was something stretching in front of me and beckoning me, and I submitted to it. It's the only way I can put it.
In The Singing Detective, your character, who has the same condition you do, says, "I've reached the end of my tether. I can't see clear of it. Even tears hurt the skin of my face. Mm. Talk about the Book of Job. I'm a prisoner of my own skin and bones." Mm. Was there a period where you felt that you reached the end of your tether?
No, not like that. I mean, that's an invention of... In The Singing Detective, I wanted to show a man with nothing except bitterness and rage reassemble himself via his cheap fiction and cheap music. I mean, they weren't the whole sources of his beginnings of self-knowledge, but through concentrating, in order to escape the pain and the humiliation of that scourge of an illness, he was remembering or trying to rewrite his own cheap detective pulp novel.
He has these fevered visions and hallucinations. Mm. Have you ever had that, and have you written your way through
that? Well, when the illness is at its height and pre the modern drugs, when it obviously the skin is a moderator too of your temperature, and when it's 100% psoriatic, and when every joint is also locked by arthritis. Your temperature goes out the window, as it were. And although...
Up or down?
Up and up and up, until you're in danger of that septicemia, which is the danger. So they do everything to bring your temperature down to a normal high temperature. At that point, although you know you're not actually hallucinating, but you do lose... Reality does shift in front of you. It's an unpleasant... It's a bit like dreaming, but you know you are. You never actually... You never don't know the difference between what is real and what isn't. But it is an uneasy... You feel that at any moment you're going to lose what is real and what isn't. That doesn't last too long. But once you experience it, you do know how perilously perched your rationality can be. You are perforce made to live in your body, and your body can let you down.
Just one last question about your condition. How has it changed your life to be able to not be bedridden and embarrassed to be seen in the way that you used to be?
Well, I have a tendency towards reclusiveness. I know that. And I know that that too can, although it's nice in a way for me, it can be dangerous. And I like, maybe one of the hidden reasons why I wanted to direct, you suddenly have to say hello and deal with hundreds of people. And in a very emotional way, I mean a very hard-working, I mean a very concentrated way. You have to be out and dealing and functioning. That, maybe I've had enough of that reclusiveness. And it's nice to be like I was at Oxford or to before, you know, when I was going to be a public man, a political man, as it were. I don't mean glad-handing.
Right.
But, you know, being out and about in the world is nice. And I'm responding to it. And it's a good creative feeling. And I'm very lucky.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you so much for spending some of your time with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Dennis Potter, the Museum of Television and Radio in Manhattan, is featuring a retrospective of his work. His new movie, Secret Friends, opens in mid-February. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. William Burroughs' novel, Naked Lunch, has been adapted into a film, but the story is told through the haze of drug hallucinations, so you might have trouble figuring out Burroughs' own story from the story of Naked Lunch. Coming up, we talk about Naked Lunch and Burroughs' life with Ann Charters, who has written about and anthologized the work of beat writers. Also, rock historian Ed Ward continues his look at rock 10, 20, 30, and 40 years ago. Today, he turns the clock back to 1962. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The first of 50 UN liaison officers have arrived in Yugoslavia. Their arrival there could pave the way for a much bigger force of peacekeepers if the current ceasefire holds. Jane Howard reports from Zagreb that there is still doubt as to whether the plan can work.
The officers will monitor the situation on the ground and report back to United Nations headquarters as to whether conditions are suitable for the deployment of a peacekeeping force of up to 10,000 men. They told reporters that they would liaise with both sides in an effort to preserve the truce. If the ceasefire holds, the UN plans to set up three protected areas in Croatia, in regions where there's been fighting and where the Serbian minority feels under threat. The Serb-dominated Federal Army has agreed to withdraw, and local territorial defense units should give up their weapons. But this may be one of the main stumbling blocks, as local Serb leaders in Croatia have repeatedly said that they oppose total disarmament. For National Public Radio, this is Jane Howard in Zagreb.
Bulgaria has now granted diplomatic recognition to six more former Soviet republics, but will have diplomatic ties with only four of them. Officials pointed to what they termed unstable conditions in both Georgia and Azerbaijan as a reason for not forming stronger alliances. Russian President Boris Yeltsin is facing some strong criticism for his economic reform policies. Bridget Kendall of the BBC reports that some Russians believe the changes are too much too soon.
Many commentators said President Yeltsin had taken too risky a step when he announced he'd head his own government and stand or fall by its reforms. But today, the Russian leader dismissed speculation he might be thinking of stepping down as head of government. He brushed aside the latest attack on his reform program from none less than the chairman of his own parliament. Yesterday, Mr. Ruslan Hasbulatov denounced Mr. Yeltsin's government as incompetent. For weeks, President Yeltsin's own vice president, Alexander Rutskoy, has been warning that without proper privatization, free prices won't be controlled by the market and the current reforms won't work. Today, the former Soviet president, Mikhail Gorbachev, added his voice too to the controversy. Mr. Gorbachev suggested he too was worried at the impact of the Russian president's price reforms. But he said another 10 days or so were needed to see if the Russian government's strategy was going to work.
Bridget Kendall in Moscow. According to Soviet economists, Russian oil production could drop to between 1.9 billion and 2.1 billion barrels a year in 3 years. In 1988, Russian oil production was up to nearly 3.9 billion barrels. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 60 points to close at 3,246. This is NPR News. Retail sales moved up 0.7% last year for the smallest advance in 30 years. In 1961, sales dropped 0.1%. Last year, because of concern over jobs and income, economists see little chance for improvement before summer. The Commerce Department also says that Christmas sales were down 0.4% compared to last year for the third yearly drop in a row. President Bush told a meeting of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce today in Washington that he blames Congress for holding up many of the Bush administration's proposals to restructure public education. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
President Bush said both the House and Senate had ignored his request for $500 million to create break-the-mold schools in every congressional district and refused to consider further deregulation of federally funded education programs. But the president singled out the Senate, saying its version of education reform offered no new ideas.
Its bill, S-2, is sponsored by Senator Kennedy, and it falls far short, tragically short, of any of our goals. And when the American people want transformation, we are being offered business as usual up there.
The president's reform package, better known as America 2000, has been embraced by most business organizations, but the administration's call for dismantling federal programs for needy school children so that the money go to the school a parent chooses has been rejected by educators and civil rights groups. The House and Senate will offer their versions of education reform next week. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
And the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled by a vote of 8-1 that states and counties may impose property taxes on Indian reservation land privately owned by Native Americans. The High Court also barred a Washington state county from imposing an excise tax on the sale of privately owned or so-called fee lands. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
Fresh air. William Burroughs' novel Naked Lunch is a classic of beat literature. It's just been adapted into a film directed by David Cronenberg. Burroughs makes an appearance in the trailer.
When I started writing Naked Lunch, people offered their opinions. Disgusting, they said. Pornographic, un-American trash, unpublishable. Well, it came out in 1959, and it found an audience. Town meetings, book burnings, and an inquiry by the state Supreme Court. That book made quite a little impression. Now, 30 years later, Hollywood, in its infinite wisdom, has turned it into a movie. 30 feet tall, in living color. Cover your eyes, America. Run for your lives!
The film, like Burroughs' autobiographical novel, is an extended drug hallucination. It might leave you with more questions than answers about William Burroughs and his work. So we invited Ann Charters to talk with us. She's the editor of the two-volume encyclopedia The Beats, Literary Bohemians in Postwar America, and she's the author of a biography of Jack Kerouac. Her new book is an anthology called The Portable Beat Reader and includes excerpts of Burroughs' books Naked Lunch and Junkie. So what does she think of the new film?
I thought it was a terrific movie. I thought it was probably the best of the movies made out of beat literature or beat experience because Peter Weller's performance as William Burroughs was outstanding. It captured the flavor of the man and his times. And I thought that the way that they adopted the book, or the book was adopted for the screen, was very imaginative and was not literally following historical events, but had a rather evocative and magical a reinterpretation of them.
How would you describe the importance of Naked Lunch?
Well, Naked Lunch was a book that was important because it challenged a lot of ideas about censorship, about the depiction of drug addiction, about the depiction of American society as a consumer society, and as a way of writing fiction that was very innovative. And so it had a tremendous reception in its time. Lots of critics, like Mary McCarthy, championed it early, so it was accepted by academics as well as by general readers. And it really launched Burroughs' career.
The title Naked Lunch was actually suggested by Jack Kerouac. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think he meant that this is what existence was, stripped of any of the superfluities of conventional or polite responses. There's a poem that Ginsberg wrote about it that I think explains the title beautifully. Want me to read it to
you?
Yeah,
please.
It's Ginsberg's poem of 1954 on Burroughs' work. The method must be purest meat and no symbolic dressing. Actual visions and actual prisons as seen then and now. Prisons and visions presented with rare descriptions corresponding exactly to those of Alcatraz and Rose. A naked lunch is natural to us. We eat reality sandwiches. But allegories are so much lettuce. Don't hide the madness. So I think that as early as 54, they had an idea of what Burroughs was doing and helped him with their sympathy and poems like this, which Burroughs certainly saw.
Naked Lunch was first published as a pulp. Do you have the original version of it?
The first Naked Lunch?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a first edition of that. Actually, it was one of those French editions that were supposedly pornographic books that could not be imported into America. The first book he wrote, which was The American Pulp, published by Ace, was Junkie.
What do the covers of those two books look like in their first editions?
Well, Naked Lunch, because it's a French Girodius edition, is much more intellectual. It's sort of an abstraction of purples and grays, as I recall. But Junkie, the first book, which is the Ace paperback, was, golly, a woman being strangled, you know, with hypodermic needles and stuff like that. That was the pulp, 1953.
Burroughs was older than Ginsberg and Kerouac,
right,
and you say
right.
He took on the role of teacher. What kinds of things did Burroughs teach Ginsberg and Kerouac?
Well, in a cultural way, he taught them about history. He taught them Spengler, I think, and the whole idea of society in a sense of collapse, a sense of crisis after World War II, rather than the conventional idea that since we'd won the war, in the 1940s, America was the strongest and the best and really facing in the right directions. Burroughs was far too perceptive to buy the official line and saw that capitalism was going to probably face a decline, that it was all based on a war economy and that the Depression really, in a central economic sense, hadn't ended. In terms of a lifestyle, he taught them a lot about drugs.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ann Charters, and for years she has been writing about the beat writers. She has several anthologies of their writing. She has a biography she wrote years ago about Jack Kerouac. Her new collection is called The Portable Beat Reader. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ann Charters is my guest, and for many years she's been writing about and anthologizing the work of beat writers. She also has a couple of books of photographs of the beat writers. Her new book is called The Portable Beat Reader. It's an anthology. Now, Burroughs' background, he was the grandson of the inventor of the Burroughs editing
right.
machine.
Mm-hmm.
So was he the heir to the Burroughs fortune? How much money did he actually get?
He got $200 a month, which basically was his parents' decision to support him. So the family really wasn't wealthy, although they had very notable people in it.
He once said that he wrote Naked Lunch to get rid of his educated middle-class background
right.
once and for all.
Right.
He put it in a much more colorful way with language we probably shouldn't use on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Could you elaborate on what he was trying to do there?
Well, this is what I think was so well shown by Peter Weller in the film version of Naked Lunch, that it was really a combination, the film of Burroughs' life as well as the book and the circumstances of him getting rid of, as you say, that conditioning, that social conditioning of his middle-class background are brilliantly and imaginatively dramatized in the film. But he has explained the evolution of his creative genius or his breaking free of these inhibitions in various ways, Burroughs, and he has made it very clear that they are tied to that accidental shooting of his wife, which he said made him a writer. He had tried to write before that and had actually finished his first published book, Junk, before the shooting, but he really became a writer, I think, trying to deal with the guilt that he felt over that tragedy.
That shooting is depicted in the movie Naked Lunch. Would you tell us what you know of the actual story?
Well, the actual story was that the shooting happened in a bar in Mexico City, not in a private apartment in Manhattan, as in the movie. So it was before witnesses, and there are many eyewitness accounts of it. It was a tragic accident. Burroughs was attempting to play William Tell with a pistol, and his wife had a martini glass or some sort of bar glass on her head instead of an apple. And unfortunately, he missed his target and shot her in the forehead. And I've seen the police photograph. Indeed, it is as everyone saw, and she was dead instantly.
How did it change his life?
Well, he said that the death of his wife gave him what he called a literary vocation. He felt, and I write about this in the headnote in The Beat Reader, he felt, Burroughs, that he'd been possessed by an invader whom he called the ugly spirit, who controlled him at the time of the accident and maneuvered him into a lifelong struggle, quote, in which I have had no choice except to write my way out, unquote. And Burroughs became a writer, he said, because he was trying to write out the ugly spirit.
What kind of state of mind was he in when he wrote Naked Lunch? Do you know? What kind of conditions did he write it under?
Well, I think the movie, again, are pretty graphic and pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of morphine, a lot of hashish, a lot of just junk in general. He was very much writing out of an addiction, and the sense of the images and the hallucinations and the sense of the language that he used to create that book is just extraordinary. And it was in Tangier, living pretty much by himself, I think, and with a few friends, that he wrote that. And in a state of near collapse after having finished it, visited by Kerouac and Kerouac typing it out and deciding to start Bill on his career, his serious career, calling it Naked Lunch and getting it published for him.
Do you have any idea how Burroughs managed to survive so many years of addiction and just mistreatment of himself?
I think heredity and a great constitution, frankly. No, he's an amazing man because he, as well as the man who turned him on to heroin, Herbert Hunky, are still alive, both of them now getting into their 80s, and hale, hearty, able to, you know, deal with everyday life, living with friends, and very, very productive people still, both of them, publishing, writing. Very few people who were addicted to, say, martinis in the 1950s survived that well.
I have to ask, you know, in the movie, the wife is addicted to bug extermination powder.
No, no, that's a metaphor for benzedrine.
Okay.
I don't think that really they took bug exterminator powder. That's part of the wonderful, in my viewing of the movie, imaginative use of the actual facts. Mm-hmm. They took benzedrine out of benzedrine inhalers, which were, you could buy them in drugstores. People used to sniff these things in the late 40s and early 50s, benzedrine. And it was a high that was relatively inexpensive. You soaked the saturated cotton in Coca-Cola or coffee, and you got really pretty high very quick. That's what Joan was addicted to.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what Burroughs' views of drugs are now?
Well, if you saw Drugstore Cowboy, that movie recently,
yeah,
with Burroughs in it,
yeah,
I think that's a pretty good statement of what his views on drugs are, that they're pretty destructive, and that he isn't, you know, puritanical in any way about it. He doesn't repudiate his own experience, but he just says, be cool, man.
Ann Charters. Tomorrow, Charters talks with us about her own experiences over the years writing about and photographing the Beat writers. Her new book is an anthology called The Portable Beat Reader, published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, what do you have?
We have news today of confirmation that Iraq did, in fact, buy nuclear technology from Germany, from a West German company, a company which may now face criminal prosecution in Germany. Also, a report on the military buildup in Iran. Also, in our continuing look at the republics of what used to be the Soviet Union, we'll be hearing about the history, culture, and a bit of the contemporary politics of the Republic of Georgia today. And closer to home, at least geographically, we'll be talking to the editor of the cyberpunk magazine Mondo 2000.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When 1991 turned to 92, our rock and roll critic Ed Ward began a survey of rock 10, 20, 30, and 40 years ago. Today it's back to 1962, the year this tune, Green Onions, was released. That same year, rock and roll was taking a breather from the musical explosion of the 50s. Payola hearings had made everybody circumspect, and about the best place to find spontaneous fun was in the big cities, in a new kind of club called the discotheque.
Like 1952, 1962 was a year when things were just about to happen. By 1962, the glory days of the 50s were a distant memory, and both the black and white musical styles that had fed rock and roll were undergoing deep changes. The Kennedy presidency had had a year to gather steam, and the civil rights movement was pressing for integration, something that was already happening in a timid way on the dance floors of big city twist clubs and, in the hands of Ray Charles, on the charts.
I can't stop loving you. I've made up my mind to live in memory of the lonesome time.
If a performer that deeply rooted in black gospel music could have a number one hit with a Don Gibson song taken from an album modestly titled New Sounds in Country and Western Music, then probably anything was possible. At least, that's what a lot of people seem to be thinking. Up in Detroit, a young man named Barry Gordy had envisioned himself as a record mogul and was trying to get two labels, Tamla and Motown, off the ground. There had been black-owned record companies ever since the 20s, but none that had attempted to challenge the mainstream pop market the way Gordy was doing. In 1961, he'd started the year with a chart-topping song, Shop Around, by his friend Smokey Robinson's Miracles, and ended it with Please, Mr. Postman, by the Marvelettes. But 62 only gave him one R&B number one. It was a good question. Twist music was everywhere, and everyone from the Isley Brothers to Frank Sinatra, Rod McEwen, and Count Basie were recording Twist numbers. Sam Cooke sang about twisting the night away, D.D. Sharp celebrated the mashed potato, the Orlans pushed the wah-wah-toosie, Little Eva gave us the locomotion, the Rivingtons thought that the bird was the word, and Chris Montez summed it all up.
Hey, baby, won't you take a chance? Say that you
besides dancing, 1962 was about helpless girls. was the heyday of the girl group, and most of the hits, like Claudine Clark's Party Lights, came from New York's Brill Building and the huge number of songwriters there. The Brill Building's greatest inhabitant, although he spent a lot of time in L.A., too, was young Phil Spector. He'd just gotten his Phillies label off the ground in 1962 and thought he understood teen psyches just fine.
He hit me, and it felt like a kiss. He hit me, but it didn't hurt me. He couldn't stand.
Okay, they wouldn't play that Crystal song on the radio? Sorry, try this.
He holds my hand, I'm so proud. Cause he's not just one of the crowd. My baby always the one to try the thing they've never done. And just because of that, they say, hey, he's a rebel and he'll never ever be any good. He's a rebel cause he never ever does what he should do just because he
supposedly the Crystals again, but actually Darlene Love, recorded on the other end of the continent. Concentrating on the charts, though, gives a skewed picture of the cultural forces at work in 1962. It might not have been the most shining moment of American popular music, not when the Four Seasons were having R&B hits, but between Motown and Detroit and Stax and Memphis, serious soul music was coming into being. The surf music era was just starting, which, among other things, meant serious electric guitar playing, and in the last place anybody would think to look, this was going on.
Von der Eaton Stark with the Stars of Liverpool, but he beat it.
Like so much in 1962, the Beatles didn't sound like much, yet.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we commemorate Martin Luther King's birthday. We talk with Claiborne Carson, who heads a project which is collecting and publishing King's papers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.